We gather, I am grateful that we gather on Treaty One land and in the homeland of the Métis Nation. I'm grateful because of the welcome. Gotta say, I'm not grateful to have to say that. And it's not about resentment about First Peoples. It's about the fact that we're still trying to figure out how to undo the mess that we made with the treaties. And that we would even need to be saying this. And we do need to say it. I'm not saying everyone needs to say it every time. That's not my point. My point is that we need to acknowledge this reality and keep it front of mind. That's partly what keeps us looking for ways to do the things that we've done poorly better, if that's within our grasp. I want us to take a few moments to breathe together this morning. And again, an invitation, if you're popping in for the first time, or if you're listening to this on the podcast, and just a reminder to our podcast listeners that I always shorten the breathing time on the podcast, but you can just hit pause and breathe until you're done and then fire it back up. But we take time to breathe together because it's a way of centering ourselves as individuals, and also because it gives us a shared practice. It gives us something to do together that brings us into a shared space. Pretty hard thing to grasp sometimes, right? What it means to have a shared ethereal, a shared spiritual space. We know from our contemporary science that we're always sharing particles, and not just with one another, but with the cosmos, that we are made of stardust, which is remarkable in itself. But it seems to me that stopping to breathe together is one of those ways we can acknowledge that reality, and we can, if not touch it, then reach toward it. We can reach toward something greater than ourselves that we share. And when we're breathing, we don't have to be concerned about what we name that. We can just focus on our breath, on our interconnectedness. And we can emerge from that and think about what we name that and why. But just for a few moments, we can just have that together. And as is often the case, stopping to breathe with a community reminds me that not everyone is able to do this freely this morning. And not everyone feels like they're able to do this freely in their daily lives, to just breathe. And so that adds to the gratitude, and it also adds to the complexity, hey? All right. Let's breathe together. Let's use the 4-7-8 practice we've been using the last while. If this doesn't kind of vibe for you, you know, breathing, go get some coffee or something and come back. We'll just take a minute for those who want to participate in this to do it together. So in for a count of 4, cradle your breath for a count of 7, out for a count of 8, and let's do 4 rounds of that together this morning, all right? Okay, let's breathe. Peace, everyone. I am so grateful for breath and life. One of the things that often brings me both joy and challenge in the life of this community is what we might sort of generically call feedback. And I get that feedback can be, you know, a bland euphemism for criticism, but that's not what I'm talking about, because, I mean, frankly, my ego is too fragile for criticism to really bring me joy, you know? Anyway, what I'm talking about are the kinds of interactions that flow my way ongoing, that the emails that I get, the text messages, the Facebook posts, conversations, even by phone sometimes. It's people thinking out loud, I think, is how I tend to view it. It's people thinking out loud about the things they're experiencing, about ideas that we're exploring together, about stories from their everyday lives, you know, all of that and more. And the details... the details are not always wonderful, because life can be a really mixed bag. Our our brief community time together this morning. Just that set of a few posts, you know, reminds us of that. I heard an old John Prine song this past week. Real heartbreaker. I mean, that guy can write heartbreakers, but this one was a like rip your heart out kind of tune. Real heartbreaker of a tune. It's about a war vet, and the name of the vet is also the name of the tune. It's called Sam Stone. And it includes this stunning line. Sweet songs never last too long on broken radios. Sweet songs never last too long on broken radios. Oh, oof. You know, as a person who writes things every week, every once in a while you run across a line where you're just like, you know, if I could write one line that good in my whole life. Oh, my word. That's us, though, right? The broken radios. And the songs, the sometimes sweet songs, those are our experiences, right? I mean, some of them truly are sweet. Some of the things we encounter in life, man, they are just so precious and so beautiful and so deep down shining with everything that is lovely and good. They take our breath away. We just don't know what to do with them. And others, not so much. So the things that come my way from this community have that same kind of mix. Some are achingly wonderful. Some are shatteringly awful. Some are as ordinary as the dishes in the sink. And, you know, that's life, right? So I experience those stories, those here's my life today moments, as a mixture of joy and challenge. And I'm so grateful to receive them because shared life is something that I believe that we're made for. My experience would suggest that we don't find it easy, though, to share our lives with others. We struggle with things like shame that keeps us hidden from one another, with fear that can make us antagonistic toward one another, with competing voices that can cause us to be confused about who to trust or why to trust at all. We struggle with the gamut of experiences in life that can be so wide sometimes that it makes us wonder if we can even discern the true nature of the place that we're in and the other beings with whom we share it. The astounding goodness we encounter in one another, the staggering brutality we're capable of, everything in between, it's a little mind-boggling. And when we dig into difficult things like our present exploration of the ongoing impact of colonialism, the ongoing inequalities and injustices in our world, the continued struggles we experience within ourselves as we seek to find ways to live that not only we, but those around us can rest easy with at night. When we do hard work like that, sometimes we really have to think hard about why we would keep doing it. And I'm not talking here about ending our lives in the literal sense, but just why would we keep auguring into difficult things, you know? For instance, what might be the value of us continuing an exploration like this one that we're in the midst of, this ongoing probing of what it might mean to be part of decolonizing religion, both within ourselves and in the culture and cultures around us? Earlier this month, CBC announced the launch of two new radio shows, one called The Block and one called Frequencies. Both are intended to, quote, bolster the discovery of Black and global music and artists and serve a greater range of musical interests and communities across Canada, close quote. As part of that rollout, as CBC sometimes does, they had this internal promotion going on, and Q host Tom Power interviewed Angeline Tetoweo, who is the host of The Block. And one of the things that Tom asked Angeline was where she feels like a show like that one fits into the wider movements of our times around things like addressing anti-Black racism. And at the heart of her reply was the idea of making space, of doing something in what she called real life, in real time, to make a time and place that could positively contribute to things like centering cultures other than the dominant ones or combating the effects of racism. Now, I do not wish to make an equivalency with this illustration, but I do wish to make an analogy. When it comes to things like decolonizing religion, short phrase for a big job, One of the realities is that it is swimming upstream. The force of the currents of religions, as is the case for other institutions, is more toward self-preservation than it is toward self-examination. So when we dig into something like the colonial assumptions that underpin so much of Western Christianity, for instance, we're not necessarily doing something that everyone is going to be excited about. Also, we may well be exploring some things that rock our personal boat. And institutions are tilted towards self-preservation because they are run by people. And generally speaking, as people, we're pretty committed to self-preservation as well. So no big surprises there. We kind of don't get to hand this off to some vague, negative thing we can just name institutions. It's us. So if we can at least agree that all is not well in both the history and the current expression of any religion that has at its core values like supremacy and entitlement based on ideology or race, then when we go exploring in those things, we're kind of in a terrain that bears some resemblance, at least to conversations about racism in general. And as with a radio show that makes space for music, art, and dialogue about anti-black racism more specifically, there needs to be spaces to consider, to talk about, to explore the decolonizing of what we believe. I think that is deeply consistent with the wider mandate of the table in general, which is making room to explore what we believe. And part of that exploration is dialogue. It's that feedback from the community that I was talking about. So, a huge part of the value of what we do as a community is in the making of space to explore things for which it might otherwise be difficult to find such a space. I was on a Zoom call with some friends last night, and people that Karina and I have known for decades, and they're older than us, retired, and have spent much of their lives occupationally involved in things that are, all of their lives occupationally involved in things that are about caring for other people. And maybe more particularly by name in things that we might have called, if we grew up around Christianity and Christian religion, ministry. And one of the people in that conversation, in that couple, they're following along with our community in this conversation about decolonization. And they just made the comment that they had never heard of the doctrine of discovery. This is somebody with a theological education. And I kind of joked. I said, "Well, that's the part they don't tell you in Sunday school, right?" And it's kind of true. Like, we can grow up around religion and never have anybody talk about the ugly bits. And so making a space where that can happen is important. And being part of the dialogue is important. This past week, Tim Penner sent me a text with a quote from a book he's been reading as part of his own research for a course that he's teaching. And the book is called Why Indigenous Literatures Matter. The author is Daniel Heath Justice. Justice is an American-born Canadian academic, a member of the Cherokee Nation. He is the professor of First Nations and Indigenous Studies and English at the University of British Columbia. That's a fairly broad portfolio. The book itself is about how vitally significant literary expression is to the political, creative, and intellectual efforts of today's Indigenous peoples. I did not write that sentence, but it's a good one. It captures the overarching theme of the book. And in the book, Justice contemplates four key questions that he would say are at the heart of Indigenous kinship traditions. This is how he articulates those four questions. How do we learn to be human? How do we become good relatives? How do we become good ancestors? And how do we learn to live together? How do we learn to be human? How do we become good relatives? How do we become good ancestors? And how do we learn to live together? Now, there's a lot more that could be said about all of that, of course. Maybe we'll have Tim Penner who has actually read the book, come and do that sometime when he isn't, up to his eyebrows and things like teaching university and being a parent with, young kids. I guess we could be waiting for a while if we're going to wait for those things to ease up, right? Maybe we'll see if Tim can pry some time loose sometime in this calendar year for that. I'd love that. While we're waiting, though, here's a quote that Tim sent me, which felt like it really kind of picked up fairly directly on the conversation that we were having last week, particularly regarding the social structures that are part of our everyday lives, the stuff from Jeffrey S. Dennis's work that contribute to sustaining what he calls laissez-faire racism. I'm just going to read you the whole quote, and just sort of, if you've been following along, listen for the points of connection. And remember, this is written from the vantage point of a First Nations scholar. Rather than see lower life expectancy, employment, and education rates, and higher rates of homelessness, substance abuse, and suicide as being rooted in generations of sustained and intentional colonial assaults on all aspects of our lives and identities, we're blamed for our supposed lack of basic human decency. Depressed, in despair, can't be due to centuries of sustained oppressive social structures and racism, must be our supposed lack of mental fitness. Come from a supportive and generally stable family without many of the overt effects of wounding? Don't assume that has anything to do with your family's good luck or the strength of your traditions or your particular capacity to overcome major obstacles. Nope. It must be due to successful assimilation and a gradual diminishment of pure indigenous influence. In this poisonous story, every stumble is seen as evidence of innate deficiency, while any success is read as proof of indigenous diminishment. In a particularly cruel twist, even our strengths are presented as evidence of our inadequacy. Tim sent me that paragraph, with the real sense that it was talking about what we'd been exploring, and I couldn't agree more. I just feel like it kind of checked all the boxes of that particular exploration, but from another vantage point. In the first part of this talky bit, I mentioned that sometimes the gamut of our life experiences is so broad that it's hard to get a handle on what kind of world we're living in. One of the ways I think that as human beings we tend to deal with that challenge is by telling stories, and particularly stories that make meaning of the world, that give us some kind of framework for what we're encountering or some kind of lens through which to view that wide range of experiences. So, for example, we might tell ourselves the story that everything has a purpose. And that story can keep us going when we encounter difficult things that we didn't see coming. We might say to ourselves, just hang in there. Everything has a purpose. Life isn't random. Now, we could just as well tell ourselves the story that life is, in fact, random, that trying to make every experience be a meaningful one is a waste of time and energy. So when the unforeseen happens, then we would put it into its place in the story by saying to ourselves something like, just hang in there. Life is random. So don't waste your energy trying to make this have to have meaning or mean something, right? Now, those two stories couldn't be much more different from one another, and yet they can both serve as ways of helping us to process what we're experiencing, right? So I wanted to tell stories that were very different in that illustration. Now, the fact that we could use two so different lenses or two different so different stories to make meaning of our life experiences suggests that they might have something important in common. Which brings me back to Daniel Heath Justice's book that the quote was from that Tim sent. Remember those four questions? How do we learn to be human? How do we become good relatives? How do we become good ancestors? How do we learn to live together? Those questions, in the context of the book, are grounded in indigenous kinship traditions. So, if that's not the tradition you or I might be from, why do those questions sound so familiar? Well, we might find ourselves going, about a question like, how do we become good ancestors? We might have to think about that. We might have to learn something more about the tradition it's from to think about what it might mean in the context of our own traditions. But even with something like that taken into account, those sound like familiar questions. And I think this points toward an important lesson that we seem to be starting to learn as a species as we make more shared efforts to learn to live well together, even as we try to respond in a more unified global way to something like a global pandemic. Although different traditions might phrase their values differently, although different traditions might ask their core questions with different words and respond to those questions with different stories, most cultures have shared ideas about what matters in the making of a good world. And it's important to remember that just because a specific word or phrase doesn't exist in another language or another linguistic culture, that doesn't mean that the idea under examination doesn't have resonance there. Very important idea. For example, the concept of human rights, which has been given a particular visible shape and language in North American and European legal systems, we talk about the legal rights of everybody, that concept has found audiences around the world. A clear majority of global cultures support human rights as a general principle, even if violations of human rights continue to occur. And it's kind of naive and sort of potentially self-soothing, but deceptive to think that countries that talk more about the importance of human rights automatically have less violations of those rights. If we just think back to our conversation last week about political avoidance norms, we might be reminded that sometimes it's more a matter of the problem not being a generally acceptable one to talk about than it is a matter of the problem not existing. We just don't have cultural permission to have this conversation, but the problem might be very real. So Canada, for example, a country that could rightfully claim to be a vocal proponent of human rights, has plenty of them going on in plain sight all the time, and many more that are hidden within unjust but familiar systems and subsequently less often challenged. Some of those violations of human rights are rooted in so-called Christian views of who has the most value as a human being, which is why we're having this conversation about decolonizing religion. So, in a complex situation like that, where we might have shared values but not shared language, where we might have shared challenges but not shared stories, what can we do to work together at making a better world for everyone? If I could definitively answer that in the next 5 minutes, I should publish. I can't, of course. But I do want to pass along an idea that feels to me like it has some good potential. This is an idea that showed up for me in my reading about how the Universal Declaration of Human Rights got drafted. That was a huge process. We're not going to talk about the process now, except to say that it involved people from a highly diverse range of cultural backgrounds, and those people came together, they discussed, they debated, and then together they created that declaration. And one of the things that that process revealed was how dialogue can lead to a shared understanding of important issues. And in many ways, that dialogue, as an illustration of a wider principle, that dialogue hinged on a shared question, which was, what might fairly be considered universal human rights? Can appreciate how important the word universal is in that question. So we're trying to answer as a group from highly diverse backgrounds, cultures, people groups, histories, circumstances. We're trying to come up with a shared answer to that question, what might fairly be considered universal human rights? That shared question idea is the one that I want to focus on. One of the reasons those four questions from Justice's book feel so familiar is because they are familiar. They might have a particular shape as he presents them because the language and the cultures from which they come, and they have a shared resonance because of the species from which they come. So, those questions, as Justice presents them, are indigenous questions. They are rooted in indigenous kinship traditions, is how he talks about it, which means they have a unique shape. They have a shape that is has been formed uniquely by those traditions and those people groups. And because indigenous peoples are human peoples, they also are human questions. They have a shared shape. If you ever want to have an interesting experience with a collection of cherished stories or sacred texts, maybe the Bible, if that's a library of stories that you hold in unique regard, if you ever want to have sort of a unique encounter with that kind of a collection, just start reading those texts through the lens of thinking of them as a recollection of attempts by various people in a diversity of cultural settings, using a variety of different languages and traditions to address themselves to those shared questions by making stories that engage with them or that make meaning around those questions. It's possible that you'll quickly begin to see that those shared human questions are everywhere. All right, now, it is my opinion. It may not be yours. It is my opinion that a table talky bit needs a word nerd moment to be complete. At least if it's my responsibility to take care of the talky bit. So, here is a word for what we've just been considering. Oh man, this is a beauty. It comes from a German philosopher named Hans-Georg Gadamer. And it's got all the things you would hope for from a German philosophical term. The word is Horizontverschmelzung. Horizontverschmelzung. I was thinking about that this morning and thinking that, you know, there's nothing quite like a German philosophical term to feel like you must be onto something important. I was like, what does that term feel like? It feels like a solid pair of boots, you know, a good pair of hiking boots. You put your feet in there and you can haul stuff. Kind of feels like that. Horizontverschmelzung. Yum. Now, this takes us back to our blurb from this week when I talked about smushing things, smushing horizons. The word means fusion of horizons. Horizontverschmelzung, smushing of horizons. You can hear it in there, right? Was it just me? Anyway, the idea is that a shared understanding can take place among participants in a dialogue within which each person in that dialogue can recognize that even though they're standing at a distinct vantage point, they are still capable of sharing a metaphorical horizon with others who are also standing at their distinct vantage points. That it's possible for people looking at a shared horizon from a variety of vantage points to experience Horizontverschmelzung, a fusion of horizons. Interesting idea, eh? So here's a, let me just see if I can connect a couple of dots here. What if the shared horizon that's possible is more about the questions than it is about any particular set of answers? What if we're all trying to answer the same or related questions, but the answers look and sound different because of their context, because of the particular vantage point from which we are looking toward the horizon of those shared questions? How would an idea like that inform the way we look at something like the intertwined nature of religion and colonization, for example? How would our unique vantage point inform the way we would look at such a question? Are we looking at it from within a cherished religion that we think of as ours? I am a Christian and I'm looking at this as a Christian. How would that be different than I'm looking at this as someone who grew up in Christianity but no longer identifies with it, no longer thinks of the divine in those terms, as Cheryl was talking about this morning? What would it look like to be looking at that kind of question of Christianity and colonization from the vantage point of someone who grew up in a tradition entirely apart from that, or maybe in a culture or tradition that was colonized under those ideas? something that we've also been kind of trying to draw on from our different vantage points. See where I'm going? Anyway, so many questions, so little time. We are going to leave it there today. And then we're going to pick it up next week with an ancient Hebrew proverb. So a different vantage point again. And we're going to do a bit more unpacking of Horizont Verschmelzung, because who could resist unpacking that? Anyway, there we go. Peace, everybody. It's been good to be with you. And we'll chat again soon.